Hello, this is Claudia Shambaugh, your host of Ask a Leader, airing on Tuesday mornings from 9 until 10. Join me as we explore the worlds of leaders of all stripes, of all ages, from all realms of our society. These leaders may be voted into office, appointed, anointed, or volunteers. We'll examine them all in this show. Subjects include politics, government, religion, human rights, culture, physical and mental health, and more. We'll find leaders in places the rest of us aren't even looking.
This is Michael Drake, Chancellor at the University of California, Irvine. And whenever I get the urge to hear the voice of independent music, I tune in to KUCI at 88.9 FM in Irvine or over the web at kuci.org.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this December 14th, 2011 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. Both of my guests this morning have been with me before. They're both men I love so much, so I'm fortunate enough to have them back on with me again. I'm joined now by Luis Urrea. Coming up in the second half hour, Peter Orner will be here discussing his latest work, Love and Shame and Love. Luis Alberto Urrea's previous books include The Hummingbird's Daughter, The Devil's Highway, Across the Wire, By the Lake of Sleeping Children, and Into the Beautiful North. He was on with me with that a couple of years ago. Born in Tijuana to a Mexican father and an American mother, he has received numerous prizes for his fiction, poetry, and journalism, including a Lannan Literary Award, a Christopher Award, a Kiriyama Prize, an American Book Award, and a Western States Book Award. He was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction. Luis has taught at Harvard and the University of Louisiana Lafayette and is currently a professor at the University of Illinois Chicago. His latest achievement is a sequel to The Hummingbird's Daughter. We pick up Teresa Urrea's life in Queen of America. It is published by Little Brown and will drive some of our talk this morning. Luis, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm sort of at the very tail end of the first leg of a crazy book tour, so I'm a little dingy, but I'm okay.
I have to say, so I've been following your progress on Facebook, and it's making me tired. Just watching you is making me tired.
I know. It's so overwhelming when you're on book tour anyway, but this one has been really, really lively, a lot more involved than previous ones, so I'm really thankful for that. But it's a test of your stamina.
Boy, no, but no kidding, no kidding. So, Teresa Urrea will not leave you alone.
She's sort of set up camp in my life, but, you know, 26 years of serving her have now ended. I'm graduating from high school. It's the world's longest high school, and now I'm kind of free to do what I want. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So for those who aren't as familiar with her, talk a little about this woman and your decision to continue her story in Queen of America.
Yeah. Well, she was known as the Saint of Cabora, but she had other monikers too. They used to call her the Queen of the Yaquis. So, of course, the Yaqui people didn't have a queen, but Westerners gave her that nickname. And she was also known as the Mexican Joan of Arc. And she was, I think, part of the messianic phenomenon that was happening in Mexico, pre-revolutionary wars. And, you know, she was actually related to the Mayo tribe, which is a related tribe to the Yaquis, but she was an indigenous child, an illegitimate child of a hacienda owner who was related to me, and semi-orphaned by circumstance. And this man, Tomas Urrea, for whatever reason, nobody really can understand why, decided to take her in rather than ignore her, which would have been the standard practice for this hacienda class back in the late 1800s. And she was studying to be an herbalist and a medicine woman and ultimately a midwife in her tween, I guess we'd call it now, sort of 12, 13 years old. under a very powerful medicine woman from the local tribes. And at about the age of 16, she had a near-death experience, after which, according to all the observers, her body began to exude the scent of roses. And when that happened, she discovered this incredible ability to heal by touch, and that kicked off just huge indigenous uprisings and warfare and so forth. And it was interestingly concurrent with some of the ghost dance, late ghost dance things that were happening in North America. And some of her followers, a town full of her followers, was massacred the same year that we unfortunately had the Wounded Knee Massacre. And interestingly, the same exact number of victims were in each place.
Hmm. That's amazing. You know, I saw a YouTube video of you visiting Teresa's house in Texas. I think this was like 2006, and there was some controversy about whether or not it was going to be torn down. Whatever happened to it?
It was saved. I was so amazed. You know, El Paso is such a great town. And it's a town like many border towns trying to struggle for survival, you know, and identity. And the city council had taken on this crazy idea that this barrio that the house is in, it's called Segundo Barrio. And if you know any of the border or revolutionary history, this was really one of the planting grounds for the Mexican Revolution. This little neighborhood, Francisco Madero was there. Mariano Azuela, the great writer who wrote The Underdogs, was writing The Underdogs basically across the street from Teresita's rooming house. Pancho Villa would hang out there. He would sneak across the border, and he would eat ice cream sundaes at the confectioners there. When there were battles in Mexico later during the revolution, people would sit on the rooftops watching from El Paso. Just an incredible story. And the city council, which was, you know, confronted with fiscal hard times, had decided that they were going to take the barrio over and turn it into a shopping mall, and the shopping mall's theme would be Revolutionary Mexican Village. And, you know, it was like, wait a minute, these are the actual buildings. You have the oldest house in El Paso is there. It's an ancient adobe sitting right there. And I thought, you're going to tear these buildings down and then build a gap that looks like the building you tore down? That doesn't make any sense.
That's the American way.
It is. And, you know, I mean, I understand that, you know, the need in the city to make a buck and to keep everything functioning. And it's a tough area. You know, it was seen as a place where poor folks and winos and all that, you know, kind of like a Skid Row-ish kind of a vibe, I guess. But it's a wonderful place, a wonderful, vibrant barrio. And I think if you go and ask the people who live there, they aren't going to tell you, well, this is Skid Row. This is, you know, where we live and have always lived. So her building is there on Oregon Street. And there's a local historian there named David Romo. And David has actually somehow orchestrated rescuing the building. And he's in there, and they've made a little Teresita museum in the building. So that makes me really happy.
That's great. That's great. So it sounds like she chose you more than you choosing her. And
that's what the shamans told me. She chose me.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like she sort of set up residence in you. And I don't know if when you were writing The Hummingbird's Daughter, if you knew that her story was going to continue on into another book. But yeah, it's interesting how deeply rooted it seems like she's taken place, you know, kind of taken up residence inside you. It's amazing.
Well, you know, I worked on those two books 26 years. And I'd say fully half of that time was deeply involved with medicine people and curanderas and you know, various tribal elders, teachers, and shamans. And, you know, it was really a different writing experience for me because it became ritual. And there's a lot in those books, I think, that is directly from ritual that was beyond anything I could have comprehended before. But I always thought I wanted to tell her entire story, but it was good for me to split it because her life was so dramatically separated between the Mexican half and the North American half. And, you know, so I thought a little break between those two would be good. It would give readers a chance to sort of recalibrate their expectations and for me to find a new voice in which to tell the American half. It clearly could not be the same exact vibe because the United States, you know, the turn of that century was just a wild, wild place. So partially I did Into the Beautiful North as practice. You know, I thought, okay, here's 19-year-old women going into the United States for the first time and in a more modern rhythm, and helped me kind of feel out some of the territory that I could then try to explore for her historically.
Is it? Is there any sense in, I mean, you seem so comfortable in writing women, and I'm wondering if that posed any problems for you inhabiting women characters so beautifully.
Oh, thanks. You know, I have to tell you, at the beginning of all this, I tried to weasel out of writing the book, and I went to women writers and tried to get them to do it. I thought, I can't do this. Are you kidding me? And, you know, they were pretty firm with me. It's your responsibility. I went to Linda Hogan. You know, people know her work as a novelist and great poet, Chickasaw writer. And, you know, I told her the whole story, and she said, well, that's great. It's a fantastic story. I said, yeah, do you want to write it? And she said, why would I write it? And I said, well, it's a woman's story. I shouldn't be writing this story. And she looked at me, and she said, but she's your woman. And I thought, oh, darn it, are you kidding? She said, you know, you're going to have to get busy and do the work. And she had become a tribal elder in her tribe right about that time. So it was really a wonderful thing talking to her about this stuff. And, you know, she was adamant, you know, medicine passes down through the female line. So it's coming at you from her and the women in your family, and it's your responsibility to learn. And it was, you know, one of those, I think, little wonderful humorous bits of the universe that when I got to Arizona to really get deeply into the research, I found out I had a cousin I didn't know who was a medicine woman from the tribe I was trying to write about.
Wow.
And, you know, things proceeded from there.
Yeah, it sounds like you had a lot of mystical experiences in writing this. You talked about a lot of just, you know, coincidental things coming up or things that told you that you were kind of on the right path with this coming up. I assume that was one of them. Were there things like that all the way along, these sort of touchstone things?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Everywhere I turned, you know, it became a really bracing experience in a lot of ways. And I'm really, you know, I'm really suspicious of the kind of new agey marketing of indigenous faiths to make a buck or to score easy points. I certainly don't intend to set myself up as a touring urban shaman or anything like that, but I tell you, it definitely entered a different reality, which, of course, they pointed out, this is reality. You just have been so distracted, you haven't noticed. And so it was a real sense of the miraculous nature of every day in our lives, and what I ended up thinking of as a matrix of sacredness. It's not religion. You know, I think even people who don't have any religious faith at all hold things sacred, and those things have power to them. And so that was a super gift to me. You know, I was thankful. I think I paid a lot to learn that stuff, because it was a very, very difficult journey to get here. But it was just an illumination at every turn, and I'm really thankful for that.
So compare writing this to writing, say, Into the Beautiful North, and sort of your process. It sounds like one sort of wrote itself, and one was a little bit more intentionally written, or, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Teresita materials were terrifying in a lot of ways for me, and the responsibility was so huge, you know, because I of course, a UC graduate, but I certainly hadn't trained in history or anthropology or anything like that. So I had to learn revolutionary history. I had to learn tribal history. You know, I had to learn all these medicine things. I had to learn all this stuff. And at all turns, you're trying to be very careful not to misrepresent any of those things, not to mention the family itself. So that was a very difficult prayer-like pursuit, writing those books. Yeah. You know, something like Into the Beautiful North, or even, believe it or not, something as dire and scary as The Devil's Highway, were lighter experiences in that, you know, you could really have fun with your craft, you could really have a fiery theme outside of yourself that you really want to represent and explain. And when Beautiful North happened, I was so kind of fried, I think, from the Teresita experience and the Border Patrol experience for Devil's Highway, that I made a little deal with myself that I was going to laugh out loud every day. I was going to write until I actually laughed. And if I was really getting a good laugh on, I'd just keep writing because I was in a good mood. I didn't know where it was going to go, but I thought if I could do this, then maybe my readers would get a laugh also and make people happy. And I didn't quite understand, no one did, that we were going to head into such difficult times in the United States. So it turned out to be an accidental boon that it made people laugh when they were feeling down. So that was a really nice thing for me.
My guest this morning is Luis Urrea. The book is Queen of America. And so many interesting things. But one of the things I always wonder about with your writing is, you know, you're so immersed in, you don't like to call yourself a border writer, but you're immersed in sort of that border culture of yeah. growing up in Tijuana, an American mother, a Mexican father, and the incredible tenderness and sensitive way that you write of, and tenderness is really the word that I'm looking for, that of the border towns and you talk about the zookeepers coming, or the people visiting the zoo coming down and just observing and sort of crassly writing without that sort of sensitivity. I'm wondering if you feel a sense of responsibility to either to a reading audience or to, I mean, certainly probably to the characters, but if there's this kind of sense of obligation that you feel having been put in this position of straddling both sides of the border to render it to people who don't understand, and if that sort of haunts you in the background of trying to render these books, or if you don't even think about it and you're just serving the characters. Does that make sense?
I think about it every day.
Yeah.
It's never far from me. You know, partially it's my new job of being on the road constantly. You know, I joke with people that I feel like a literary Bachman-Turner overdrive, you know, going to state fairs and bowling alleys to play the greatest hits. I'm on the road all year, and it's often to speak about immigration issues. You know, lots of schools and cities have been using the Devil's Highway and Into the Beautiful North as their all-city reads, or their all-campus reads. So I'm out there all year long talking about this stuff. And I realize that I'm representing people that are misrepresented and reviled for no good reason and attacked. And it's not alien to me. You know, my family went through the same kind of thing. And so I feel like I represent as best I can all of that culture.
Yeah. The other thing that you said about this book, which I thought was really interesting, is having to fictionalize it in order to tell the truth about it. And, you know, if you'd written this as a biography, it wouldn't have the power and wouldn't tell the sort of human truths about this woman that fiction does.
Well, certainly, you know, here's the thing about fiction for me. I'll tell you a couple of what I hold dear in all this. First of all, I think, you know, you can know a subject much more profoundly in a good piece of long-form fiction than you could in a footnoted book, because, you know, it's in fiction, I think, that one gets to dream, and not only to dream, but to enter someone else's dream. You know, in the process of writing the Hummingbird books, both of them, the shamans give you dreams. I had never experienced this before. I had medicine people give me dreams. And certainly in the first book, there's a series of dreams spaced out throughout the text, which are actually in series the dreams they gave me. And I realized that they were giving me a dream narrative as a kind of a skeleton for the novel. Just a remarkable experience. Including the final visionary dream in Hummingbird's Daughter. And we revisit some of those dreams in Queen of America. That's something that's hard to explain. You can't footnote a dream. You just can't footnote it. It's there, and, you know, nonfiction work, one of my little secrets is this, that we are all separated by borders. I just happened by accident to have been born on the other side of the Mexican border, but that's simply a metaphor for the fences, walls, and scars that are between all of us. All one has to do is turn on the news, CNN, anytime to see the walls and borders and barbed wire fence and scars between us all, whether it's liberal and conservative, man and woman, black and white, you know, Muslim and Christian, straight and gay, you name it, those borders are there. Every audience I speak to is completely riven by borders and fences. They just don't see them. So I've been given the gift of an incredibly vivid metaphor for what is ailing us as a family.
As you were doing the research for this, I was wondering if there were any inconvenient truths that you came upon in your research that didn't fit the kind of the coordinates of the book or your thinking about character. And it, do you work with them or do you ignore them or what do you do with them?
You can't ignore them. You know, I've tried to my detriment to ignore the stuff I didn't like. And so I've realized that I have to represent it, even the things I don't like. You know, when I was doing Devil's Highway, for example, you can imagine that I had a particular vision of the U.S. Border Patrol.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was walking in there thinking, oh, I'm going to be a great witness to all of humanity except those bastards over there. I'm going to do one on them. And then to find out that those agents were human, and not only did I like them, but I ended up really loving a couple of them, was such a shock to me. And I realized that I was not writing up to my full potential if I was not going to recognize their humanity as well and try to understand the world they were in. Because that's my job. That's my job. And if I shirk those responsibilities or that consciousness of what I have to do, that's a failing on my part. You know, and sure, there's stuff in Queen of America that made me very uncomfortable, but that's just the story as I uncover it, and I'm trying to do honor to this woman's experience as best I can. You know, one of the critics have been incredibly positive, which I'm, of course, thankful for, but one of them took me to task, you know, for her not, in my story, being more of a revolutionary leader. And I thought, well, I can't go back in a time machine and change what happened to her. This is what happened to her. It's historical fiction. You know, certainly if I were writing a novel that I had imagined, perhaps she would have been a great war leader and toppled the government, but there were other paths she went.
Do you think there was something about her being a relation of yours that made this more urgent for you, that if she would have, you know, just been a figure from the past, that you wouldn't have felt this tie? Or do you think there's something in the family relationship that gave her a sense of urgency and a, you know, compellingness to the story?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you read millions of things about interesting characters, you know, and you think, that's so interesting. And then you move on to the next trivial bit. And the only things available about her were semi-trivial, small comments here and there that she existed. But, you know, when you realize that this is a woman that's in your bloodline, in fact, I was taught as a little kid that she was my mysterious aunt. And for a while, I thought she was still alive somewhere. And you know, that's overwhelming. You keep thinking about my tia. Wow, my tia did all this stuff, really? You know, and now in my family, I'm the deal, you know? I'm the guy with the books, and I have interviews, and I show up in the newspaper, and I realize that when I meet the younger generations in my family, I think, wow, this was kind of the vibe that I had. This is my ancestor who's doing this interesting stuff. And, you know, just on book tour, this beginning of this book tour in San Diego, they brought around a recalcitrant 13-year-old boy who's secretly writing poetry now. How happy was I? You know, I couldn't believe it.
That's so great. My guest this morning is Luis Irrea. The book is Queen of America. And Yeah, that's great. It's funny, when I was comparing this to Peter Orner's going to be on the second half hour, and he was writing about his grandfather, but from kind of an opposite perspective, you know, that he sort of found love through his grandfather through all of his mistakes and faults and shames and things. And so I thought how these people in our family loom so large, one way or the other, they loom so large, and the ways their ghosts sort of, you know, carry on in the generations below them is interesting.
I think their shadows walk through our stories even when we don't know it all the time.
Yeah, it's hard to. And the other thing I think is interesting is writing about places where you grew up, and you know, I think the places that you live when you're a kid are so much more viscerally imprinted on your brain than, you know, the places you live as an adult. And your sense of place in this also is just so fantastic. Your sense of place is always so fantastic. But
thanks.
Is it easier for you to? To write about a place where you currently are, or is it easier to kind of have some distance from a place when you're writing about it?
You know, it's a little bit of distance. I realize that places enter the mythology inside of you, and it depends. You know, I write a lot on the road. I love being on the road, not necessarily like this, millions of jets to millions of public events, but, you know, driving across the United States, that's talk about person's sacredness. That's a sacred thing to me, and I feel like my neighborhood is the USA, so I want to see, hey, what's going on over here in Utah? You know, what's going on in Tucumcari, New Mexico right now? And we go out, and that stuff is vivid and exciting and fun. I don't know if it's for public consumption or not, but it's my favorite writing. It almost looks like strings of haiku, you know, caught on the fly. But for it to turn into art, I think it needs to percolate a little bit and settle in. Like, I'm noticing that lately I've been writing little things about Louisiana when I didn't really write about it when I was there very much. So it gets into you and it becomes part of your dream. And then once it's there, it comes back out in the art.
That's great. We're drawing down on our time, but I'm wondering if you can offer advice, particularly you had some great notes on writer's block that I've read about before, kind of how you deal with them. Can you leave us with some words of wisdom on writer's block and your thoughts on it?
Writer's block. Wow. You know, writer's block. Well, the one thing I try to tell everybody is that, you know, it depends on your approach to writing. I really learned this from William Stafford's poetry and his son, Kim. You know, William Stafford used to say this hilarious thing, which was, if you want to be a successful writer, the first thing you need to do is lower your standards. And I thought, lower your standards, that's really funny. And I used to teach that until Kim pointed out that, yes, it's funny, but also he was a pacifist. And lowering your standards, of course, is the ancient sign on the field of battle that you're not going to engage in warfare, that you're going to put the thing down and collaborate. And that struck me as a brilliant approach to writing, that we're not fighting this thing. There's writing is interactive and aware in itself, and if you're coming forward in partnership with it to play or to pray or to create together or to give a little bit of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to the spirit of writing, then it works with you. The world responds by giving you things, and you can write about them. And the most simple way to get out of writer's block is to sit down and write a piece about the nature of the writer's block. You find yourself writing pretty eloquently about what it is that's stopping you from writing, and then guess what? You're writing.
I like it. Luis Irrea, this is always a pleasure. This was a huge pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Luis Alberto Irrea. The book is Queen of America. It is out now. Great pickup to where the hummingbird's daughter left off. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Peter Orner will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back.
come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over.